Hello and welcome to Life Sentences. I'm Caroline Baum. Was she an eccentric? Was she mad? Why did she sleep rough, recite poetry in public, and get arrested for jumping into and out of taxis without paying? Mythology has obscured the facts about B. Miles, a larger-than-life, flamboyant personality who added a bit of bohemian colour to Sydney for much of the 20th century, which is odd. How do you become famous for being basically homeless and unconventional? First-time biographer Rose Ellis decided to find out. Doing so required medical detective work as well as grappling with the complex intellectual and political debates of the times when rationalism, nationalism, and eugenics were powerful forces. What she discovered makes B an even more intriguing figure. I spoke to Rose in Sydney. Could you start by telling us who B. Miles was?
B. Miles was born in 1902 into an extremely wealthy family, and she was born in Sydney. It's hard to encapsulate exactly what she was and what she became because she was so many different things to so many different people. But let's just say she was someone who lived a very public life in Sydney and beyond Sydney, in fact, across Australia from the 1920s to the 1970s. She was a street performer. She was a writer. She was a social critic. I think about her as a public intellectual. And she was someone who managed to create an enormous sense of affection from the public and create an enormous sense of rancour by the police and by authority in general. And in the process of that, she became a cultural icon of the last century.
That's a beautiful encapsulation that contains so many different things that we're going to try and unpack in the course of this conversation. But I'm interested in the fact that she's such a paradox in so many ways. Why is she so enduringly famous, given that she left no published works and there are no other obvious conventional achievements to speak of?
I know, that's the thing. I think it was because she was so visual. I mean, she was out in public space all the time and she was up close and personal. I mean, this is a woman who's very famous for just jumping into people's cars as they were sitting in the traffic and, you know, the Shakespeare recitations, her very sort of theatrical persona, the fact that she wouldn't be quiet, the way that she gave these great speeches from the dock in court. I think it was her visual presence and it was a constant. You know, she was visually present throughout most of the last century.
And I guess it was that she was a sort of very early sort of prototype, if you like, of the kind of outrageous celebrity who kind of gathers celebrity to themselves for apparently not very much, but the media adopts that person. And in fact, one of the things that you do in your biography that I think is really interesting is you do explore the legend that she became and the way that she has been mythologized. So, for example, some listeners will be familiar with her as the subject of Kate Grenville's fictional telling of a section of her life in her novel Lillian's Story, which also became a film. So do you think that, I mean, in a way, it's an unbalanced narrative, isn't it, in that there's been more made of her by other people than she possibly made of herself in her own lifetime?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't have put that better myself. She really did. I mean, she did enable that. She would, you know, come to court with press releases.
Yes.
And on a dull day, she would, when she didn't have much media attention, which was not often, she would go into the offices of the Herald and sort of say to journalists or editors, you know, interview me. You know, so she, although she always denied it, she did sort of promote that notion of celebrity. But you're right, there was something about her that captivated people and resonated and enabled her to stay in the sort of the mythology about Sydney and Australian characters. Absolutely.
Yes, she's become a sort of an urban icon, and it's ironic that she always claimed that she did not want to be known.
Yes.
And she became not only famous, but notorious. And as you say, she was quite adept at manipulating that. So we'll come back to that. But I want to know, Rose, what first brought her to your attention as deserving of a biography? Because I have to admit that when I found out that you were doing this, I had a little moment of envy that you had locked onto this subject because it's so rich and juicy. But I was amazed that no one had done it before you.
Yes, and people often say that to me, that why hasn't anyone done this before? So I think because she has been sketched so much in these little vignettes and portraits, and every time there's an anthology about Sydney or a history of Sydney or, you know, one of those anthologies of famous Sydney eccentrics, she's always in there in a chapter, you know, like Rat Bags by Keith Dunstan, that sort of thing. And I guess people just thought, well, that's all there is to the story. But what happened was, I mean, you know, I spent most of my growing up years in Sydney, and so I obviously knew a little bit about her and heard stories about her from my relatives, my older relatives, when they were telling stories about Sydney. I'd heard that, you know, that oft-quoted expression that she had had her brain overturned from too much study at university, you know, which is just so ludicrous, but was the trope. And then I read her manuscripts in the Mitchell Library. And what became clear to me was this was a person who had not lost touch with reality, who knew exactly what was going on and what was being done to her, and was able to connect that to sort of the broader ideas around her at the time. And in particular, when I read Prelude to Freedom, which is a manuscript that describes her first committal period into what they used to call hospitals of the insane from 1923 to 1927. And that was a, you know, that is a vivid piece of writing. It's harrowing at times. It's poignant. It's ironic. It's disturbing. But what is abundantly clear from that is that this is a woman who's incredibly lucid and clearly should not have been there in the first place, was not in what they would have called insane, and shouldn't have been there. And I thought, well, what's going on here? What are the forces? What were the sets of ideas in that period that were enabling women like B, who were different, to be locked away like that? And if not locked away in an asylum, then arrested and jailed repeatedly in prisons and lockups all over the country. And I thought, how interesting to look at that period through the lens of someone who's always pushed to the margins, but absolutely knew the centre, absolutely knew what was going on. And that's what sort of drove me to do the biography.
Okay, so never having done this before, how did you begin?
I was very fortunate to meet her nephew and his wife, and they were absolutely fantastic. And also other relatives, other descendants of her brothers were also really great. What was really key and what was really the big break for me was getting access to her case notes.
How did you do that?
I had to seek permission from the Department of Health and from state archives and lots of other bodies, and it took a long time. And of course I had the family permission as well, but that took a long time to do. And there had been an article in a health and history publication, a peer-reviewed publication by two psychiatrists, Dr. Edwards and Dr. Kaplan, that looked at the case notes. So that was helpful because I could sort of go to the department and say, look, they've already been publicly discussed. But in order to get them into a book, I had to go through the whole process again. And it took a long time.
Right.
But they were the key, because you've got Bee's narrative of what's happening to her in the asylum, And then I found a fantastic memoir by a doctor called A.T. Edwards, different to the other Edwards, who was a psychiatrist at the time when she was in the asylum and wrote a beautiful memoir called Patients of People. And he described the wards. And when I compared that to the way that B described the wards, they're almost like mirror image. They're very aligned as far as that sort of the whole gothic nature of what was happening in the 20s in asylums. And then I had the case notes so I could compare what the psychiatrists and the nurses were saying compared to what B was saying. So that was just illuminating. That was a game changer.
Yes, I can see it would be. Well, we'll come to that period of her life, but we have to start with her father because he is this looming, powerful, charismatic, difficult figure in her life. So tell us a little bit, give us a kind of snapshot, if you can, of William and his ideas and his beliefs.
Yeah, he is a complicated figure. So he was born in 1871, I think, and he came from a family that was already wealthy. So he inherited a lot of wealth and built upon that wealth. He was an accountant, and he also was a major shareholder and director of Pepys and Co., which is an exclusive menswear store. The building is still there, magnificent seven-storey Georgian facade next to Wynyard Station in George Street in the middle of Sydney. And he was a member of the New South Wales Shakespeare Society. He was a member of the Philharmonic Choir and St Mary's Cathedral Choir. So he was involved in very much in the cultural life of the city as well as the mercantile life of the city. He was a member of the Chamber of Commerce, but he was also a radical nationalist. So he sort of came in on the tail end of that 1890s nationalism and took up the whole rationalist movement with great fervour. So he was a founder of the New South Wales Rationalist Association. He moved in rationalist circles. He didn't allow his children to attend any kind of religious services or go to Sunday school or anything like that. They were all raised as atheists. And he had a particular obsession with Australians not fighting in overseas campaigns. So when the First World War came around and Hughes wanted to introduce conscription for people to continue fighting in the First World War overseas, he joined the anti-conscription campaign with absolute fervour, and he was down at the Domain, you know, with these radical unionists, the Wobblies, and pacifists,
yes,
and
wonderful
feminists.
Name. The Wobblies, I
the
love
Wobblies.
Them.
Yes, it's great. And, you know, the Wobblies were continually getting arrested and put in jail for sedition and suspicion of arson, and, you know, they were the enemy of the state.
So they would have been viewed as terrorists.
They would have been viewed as terrorists and were. And there he is down there, an incredibly effective speaker, apparently, joined the anti-conscription campaign, going down to the, you know, I just love this image of him. He's in his beautifully appointed offices in Chalice House in Martin Place as this very expensive, exclusive financial advisor, you know, owner of Pepys and all these other different interests he's got. And then in the afternoon, you know, he walks out of his door and he walks down to the Trades Hall and sits down with, you know, radical unionists and plots the demise of the Hughes government. It's fantastic.
It is. It's a complete double life. And I mean, it's really fascinating to think about what B inherits from him. She obviously inherits that ease in public. That love of Shakespeare is something that he passes on to her. Obviously, he was completely unconventional in his thinking, and she was too. But what's so interesting is the dynamic between father and daughter. Now, B came to believe that her father hated her. He beat her. He claimed that she had an unhealthy fixation on him. How do we begin to unravel and understand what was going on between them?
It's a fascinating dynamic, and I think it dominated both their lives, throughout their lives. such strong emotions between them both. It was difficult to decipher. I think that he was incredibly proud of her. He was proud of her intellectual strengths, which were obvious from a child, and her love of Shakespeare, her capacity to memorise great passages of Shakespeare, which she was doing from a child. She did inherit his love of performance. She certainly embodied all his political ideas. You know, there's this period during conscription, the conscription debates, where she was the only one in her school, apart from her sisters, wearing the no badge for conscription, against conscription, and it pitted her against all her teachers and all her classmates.
Mm.
And she learned the art of opposition. She learned to challenge. She learned to take it on, and she learned to debate, which is, you know, very much in the rationalist tradition. And so I think she really admired him. But at the same time, you know, she's a young, smart woman who's strong-willed and has ideas of her own and interests of her own. And when those interests start to clash with his, then you start to feel the full force of his personality. The other thing about him is that he was an absolute control freak.
Yes, I was going to say, this is really a struggle for control.
It's a struggle for control. So when her ideas aligned with his, he was fine. When her ideas started to go in a different direction, you know, that's when the trouble started. She started hanging around with interesting people, poets and writers, dabbling a little bit in that bohemian milieu, which he would have too. He would have too, because all of those lines intersect, because we're talking about a small community of players, you know, politically, intellectually, artistically, they all overlapped and interlinked. And maybe he didn't like the fact that his daughter was, you know, playing in his field, but maybe that was it. I don't know. But the other dynamic, of course, is the relationship with the grandmother, because the grandmother's incredibly important. She was this very famous contralto. And what I found fascinating was she's not really known in the family. So the generations below B didn't really know much about her. But in her time, she's incredibly famous. She's considered the finest contralto in the colonies. And she and B had a particularly close relationship. It's William's mother. I think William and his mother seem to have had a fairly sort of volatile relationship. And so I think that's another dynamic which comes to play when she's in the asylums. It becomes very, very obvious that there's a lot of strain there in that sort of triangle of relationships. So I think that was a part of it. And he was also a violent man.
Yes.
He had a ferocious temper and no patience for people who didn't agree with him, politically or personally.
Now, in one of the most kind of explosive accusations that she ever makes, B actually accuses him of incest. Is there any evidence of that? She says that he's obsessed with her and that he has molested her.
She says he was incestuous towards me. It's the towards. So we don't know. We don't know if there was actually something physically happened or whether it was his behaviour, whether he was just appeared to be predatory towards her.
Mm.
Certainly he kept claiming that she had a fixation on him.
Exactly. It's interesting, isn't it, that they're both blaming each other of an unhealthy obsession.
That's exactly right. They're both blaming each other. So it's hard to know. What I could prove, because it happened often publicly, was that he was very physically violent with her, and he did it in front of other people. He did it in front of strangers. So that was easy to prove.
Mm, that's fascinating that he was prepared to do that, to beat her, to hurt her physically, with witnesses, whereas you would think that that would be something that would happen very much behind closed doors in the privacy of their great mansion, which I wanted to ask you about the house, Ambleside.
Oh, yes.
Still stands today, and you went to visit it.
I did. It was fantastic to see the music room. It was absolutely, it's a remarkable room. These beautiful stained glass windows that reach down from this vaulted ceiling to the floor with five composers. There's a sort of panel, actually I think there's about seven panels, and they've got a composer in each of the panels. And above them are these classical female figures, one holding a scroll, one holding a basket of fruit, one holding, I think, some wheat, you know, the sort of the gifts of industry and culture, and a piano in the middle where she would sit as a child under her grandmother's supervision and learn the piano. And she played the piano beautifully for most of her life.
So she did, in a sense, grow up very much in privilege and in a kind of gilded cage, I suppose we could say.
Very much, very much. So it was a round of opera, concerts, bush picnics. They had a tennis court, you know, tennis parties. Yes, very much a, as you say, a gilded cage, an upper middle class life.
Mm. Now, I guess the sort of the crucial interpretation that you bring to your biography, this is the really important thing, is that you have a theory that Bee's increasingly erratic behaviour arises because she suffered from a form of encephalitis, which she got when she was about 18. She was sitting university entrance exams at the time. I wonder whether you could tell us what the characteristics are of this particular kind of encephalitis and how you arrived at the conclusion and at the diagnosis that you do.
Ah, yes. So encephalitis lethargica, it was a pandemic that ran from about 1917 to 1924. It was rampant in Europe and Britain and America. It came to Australia via an Anzac returning to Tasmania and spread right up the coast. And she contracted when she was 17, almost 18. As you say, sitting her entrance exams for university, she developed this double vision, got these headaches that were so severe she thought she was going to die. In fact, she almost did die. So encephalitis lethargica, which ran in tandem with the Spanish flu and more or less overshadowed by the Spanish flu, people don't really know about it. It's a forgotten pandemic. If you had EL and you were lucky enough to survive it, because initially the mortality rate was quite high, your life was not the same again. Because what became apparent over a period of time, that EL sufferers developed these radical behaviour changes. So there were things like, physical things like sensitivity, photosensitivity to light. And if you think about Bee, she always had that tennis visor on her head. There were things like that people couldn't concentrate. You know, what people might think about the symptoms of ADHD today, although it is different. People couldn't concentrate. They couldn't sort of control their emotions. But one of the main things was they couldn't control their impulses. So they would be impelled to do things without really understanding why they were doing them, not necessarily seeking any outcome. And they also had to move all the time. So they got this sort of hyperkinetic behaviour where they were just constantly moving. There were EL patients that were found wandering around Europe for years with no destination in mind. They just had to keep moving. It was called wanderlust. Lovely name.
Yes.
Terrible condition. So that was part of it. And this constant restlessness, this impulsiveness, this inability to control your impulses. And what people, so the medical profession and parents in particular, became particularly concerned about was the effect on young people, because EL seemed to target people under 40 and particularly young people. Now, Bee was 17 when she contracted it. And what they were worried about was, because of this lack of inhibition was another one. Because of this lack of inhibition, this lack of inability to control your impulses, this constant drive to be moving all the time, that they would naturally end up in the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
So in Britain, for example, laws were changed to recognise EL sufferers. There were institutes set up in London and in the States and in Europe to try and treat people, although there really wasn't much you could do. And also a lot of EL sufferers ended up in asylums. The other thing that happened, which didn't happen to be, was that most people went on to develop this form of Parkinson's where their faces became very rigid and mask-like. They lost control of their muscles and movement, and they ended up in this sort of catatonic state. So that film Awakenings,
yes,
with Robert De Niro, they are where Oliver Sacks treats them with lithium, I think. They are EL sufferers.
Are they?
Yes, that are in this catatonic state, and he sort of wakes them up. That was the usual destiny for EL sufferers, but not her. So the difference with, I mean, people's lives were destroyed and their families' lives were destroyed because they were just impossible to control. And there's this famous saying that EL made good boys bad and bad boys worse. So whatever were your predisposition, it sort of exaggerated it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because what you're talking about, that extreme form of disinhibition, expresses itself really very clearly in Bee's behavior, and in a sense, in a way that she has no awareness of social boundaries of any kind.
And what's interesting to me is that she kind of turned that into an ascetic, into a philosophy, into a way of living. She was able to intellectualize it. That's what I found so interesting.
How did you work out that this had what had happened to her and that that determined all that happened to her subsequently?
I don't know that it determined all that happened to her subsequently, but I think it did absolutely govern her life and govern a lot of her, what people couldn't work out why she was, you know, this sort of obsession with taxis and movement and things like that. I think that was absolutely driven by her EL. I did a lot of research into EL, and some work had been done on looking at her and EL by those two psychiatrists, Rob Kaplan and Dr. Edwards. I've forgotten his first name. And I spoke to a lot of people who were authorities on EL, one doctor in particular who'd written fabulous, sort of the most up-to-date and authoritative text on EL. And I spoke to him in particular about Bee's situation. And it seemed to me that once I had, and it was well documented that she had it, you know, it's in her records.
Just that no one had sort of joined the dots in terms of how that might have informed subsequent behaviour.
No, they hadn't. And in particular, the people who were charged with her care.
Is there a cure for this now? Is this a disease that's been eradicated?
No, it's sort of died out. I think there was a case in Forbes in the 1950s, but it has sort of, yeah, they think it's died out.
So given what he knew at the time, her father has her committed. And I was wondering whether you could give us a sense of how Bee coped with that incarceration and what happened to her when she was in Gladesville Hospital, how she was treated, how her life sort of evolved there. Because, for example, you know, you could say, if you're just looking at the sort of superficial aspects of this, that's where she probably collected herself a very fruity vocabulary of swearing and obscenities.
Absolutely. She loved it. The fine art of swearing, she said. Yeah, absolutely. She used to love to shock her parents when they came to visit her. I think it was the defining moment of her life. I think it's where she learned to value freedom. I think that's where she learned to venerate freedom. as a goal that she would seek to reach all her life. But I think, and also running underneath that is the act of betrayal by her father, because her father was not only instrumental in committing her into the asylum, but trying, you know, his hardest to keep her there.
Yes.
You know, and bringing her back when she repeatedly escaped. The asylum wasn't particularly keen on having her back. It was him pushing it. So I think that absolutely. And I think that, you know, it's fascinating to me in her description of life in the asylum, which is a, you know, it's an amazing thing to have that description, because we don't have the patient's viewpoint very much, you know. And so it is incredible, and so vividly rendered and so clear. You know, there's real clarity around those descriptions. I think that when you read that, you do get this sense that she at first thinks, she tries to be sort of nonchalant about it and sort of say, oh, well, you know, the experience isn't going to do me any harm and it'll improve my powers of observation. And she almost sort of approaches it like an anthropological study. And then the reality sort of starts to kick in that actually I'm not going to be in here for a few days. I'm going to be in here for the long haul. Mm. And she does everything she can to resist the authority of the asylum. And you know, what also becomes apparent is the limited options for treatment in that period. So really most of the treatment was these powders and things that they would dose them with, which seemed pretty ineffectual, or restraint. Mm-hmm. So there's no chemical restraint, so it's got to be physical restraint. So they are strapped, a lot of the women are strapped to seats for days and weeks at a time. And that memoir I was talking about before, A.T. Edwards' memoir, also talks about that. Just this in people inert and left in absolutely filthy states. And also the reluctance of the nurses to have any physical contact with the patients, which, you know, there's that very graphic scene where she sees a patient who has been sort of kept inert on these seats and has in a straitjacket and has soiled herself. Mm. And the nurses don't want to clean her, so B gets a hose and strips herself down and hoses her off in the courtyard. You know, I mean, this sort of,
so a complete lack of compassion and dignity.
Complete lack of compassion and dignity, and also resources. I mean, by this stage in the 20s, you know, asylums are overcrowded, under-resourced. Psychiatry is a kind of a low-value profession in the medical profession, and people are locked away.
Well, but can I ask you, Rose, about what parallels occurred to you subsequently in the narrative when she's in jail? Because we should say that B has some kind of record for being arrested over and over and over, and she does spend considerable amounts of time in jail. And at some points in her life, when she's homeless, which we'll come to, it actually seems to suit her to be in jail in the winter when it's cold. And again, it gives her a kind of structure. I mean, given that she's someone with no sense of boundaries, it gives her a sort of structure and a routine around writing. She has uninterrupted time to write when she's in jail. So can you just compare the hospital time with the jail time?
It's really interesting, isn't it? I think in jail, I mean, you know, she's not at all a stupid woman. And I think she sort of realised that when she's in jail, she kind of her options for disruption are much more limited. And any sort of form of disruption in jail might mean more jail time.
And hurt, and being hurt, or pain, or punishment.
And being hurt, or punishment. Although, you know, she was pretty strong physically and, in fact, would often provoke fights in the asylums to pass the time. I don't think I don't think she did that in jail. There was a couple of, when I looked in the records, there was a couple of incidents of fights, but not really many. In jail, she tended to keep to herself. In the jails, the difference was too that she had a cell to herself. That was the rule. Whereas in the asylum, she was in a ward with other women. And in the nighttime, that's when the chaos sort of started in the wards, and everything was, you know, it was, there was uproar and pandemonium at nighttime because there was limited supervision.
Now, William, her father, accused her of, or certainly believed that she had homosexual tendencies, and I'm assuming that he would have been violently homophobic. At 21, she says that she's still a virgin. Do you think that she ever had a sexual relationship of any kind?
Oh, she absolutely had sexual relationships, yes. She had sexual relationships, particularly once she was out of the asylum and she had immersed herself in Bohemia and was living this fabulous life. Yes, she had a lot of sexual relationships. She used to keep a ledger. So she did. And then when she was about 32...
What kind of sexual relationships were they? I mean, are we talking about one-night stands? Are we talking about knee tremblers in a back alley? What are we talking about? Let's get specific.
No. I think as far as we know, I think, you know, she would have relationships that might have lasted a little while. They never lasted, you know, a long time. I mean, there was just that great story that these two elderly gentlemen told me about... They were living in the Cross. This is in the late 20s, and they knew B, and they really liked B, and she was in a relationship with this guy, and he wanted to get out of the relationship, and he had come to their flat and said, "I have got to get away from this woman, and I'm leaving on the boat tonight." So she got wind of it and supposedly raced down to the harbour and grabbed onto the anchor rope and was swinging across the bow of the ship, trying to land on the deck, much to the horror of this guy who thought he'd finally escaped. So, yeah, no, she was known to have relationships. She did fall in love in her early 30s, and that's when she decided that she would lead a life of simplicity and virtue. And she was with this person whose identity, frustratingly, we don't know, for, I think, several years. But it didn't work.
Wait a minute. This identity we don't know. Who are you? Male? Female? What are you telling us?
Male. He was a businessman. That's all she'd say.
So do we have to assume that he was married?
He was married. But I don't think she knew he was married at the time. And I'm not sure. It's not clear whether he was married at the time or he subsequently got married after the relationship with her ended. I think it was probably the latter. And when she discovered he was married, she said she ceased to be in love with him because she was absolutely opposed to marriage and she didn't like men who wanted to get married. So it's a little bit hazy, but I think she was in a relationship with him. She was passionately in love. She didn't like being in love. She found being in love very, very challenging, and you can see her wrestling with that in one of her manuscripts a lot. While she's travelling, she's really pondering about love. What does it mean? You know, how could I handle this? But anyway, that relationship ceased, and after that she really didn't have any more, I think, significant relationships with men.
Maybe it would be a good idea at this point to describe her physical appearance because there are so many contradictory descriptions of her. She's described at one stage as a young woman as beautiful with this kind of fashionably shingled hair. And then, of course, much later on in life, we know her as this sort of bloated, overweight, rather moon-faced creature.
I think she was absolutely striking looking when she was young. She was incredibly athletic. She was a very, very strong swimmer and she had this sort of vigour around her. She's about 5'8", I think, 7 or 8 in the old measure. A light brown, almost blonde, bobbed hair, as you say, large blue eyes, very striking bone structure, a broad face. But everybody used to comment about her freshness. There was a freshness and a vitality about her. She was almost like that iconic outdoor Australian girl, that sort of figure. And she would dress in these very brief white shorts, which women did not wear in public in those days, and a white shirt and flat pumps. And that was sort of her everyday outfit. Or these extravagant evening dresses, you know, looking absolutely stunning. And people would always comment about, oh, the first time I saw her, I was blown away, you know.
Did she wear those evening dresses during the day, or did she
sometimes,
wear evening? Right.
No,
okay.
Sometimes, you know, she would turn up in a funeral in a black ensemble, you know, this sort of thing, or riding her bicycle in an evening dress.
And she never, for example, I mean, I'm just dwelling on this for a moment. I'm intrigued that she wore shorts. Did she cross-dress a bit?
No, not. Oh, yes, yeah, sort of. Yeah, I think you could say that she did. She had some, there was a particular article I remember, this journalist, they were always commenting about her, you know, or B appeared or saw B on a tram. And there was this one sort of snippet in the paper, B's back in town. I saw her alight from a tram. She was wearing a golfer's outfit. It's hard to tell whether she's a male or a female.
Okay, so she obviously had quite a heightened sense of dress as costume.
Very much, and that was part of that bohemian, that sort of, it was a political statement almost by bohemians to dress against convention and to be slightly outlandish. And yeah, and she was very slim, very slender, and could carry herself extremely well. You know, there was something quite elegant about her. Fast forward 6 years to 1944, and she's very large, very large. So she gained an awful lot of weight very quickly in that period, which, again, EL sufferers had a tendency towards obesity. And the whole way she dressed and everything else had changed. And by that stage also, though, she was becoming homeless.
Quite, yes. Now, before we get to the homelessness, I just want to go back to you describing the fabulous life that she lived, because there is a part of her life where she is sort of fully immersed in and embraced by Bohemia. So what was Sydney like as a bohemian town in the 1920s? How does it compare with bohemian life in Europe? It sounds like it was pretty exciting and crackling here.
It does, doesn't it? And so everything I've read about it and interviews with people who lived through that period, absolutely. It was just like an endless party. I mean, really. And people did outrageous things, and the way you lived wasn't just your artistic output. It was the way you lived. The way you lived was an art form. Everything was you did and said was some kind of artistic expression. And, you know, and they had their own clubs where, you know, like Packy's Club in Elizabeth Street.
Where she performed nude reviews.
Performed nude reviews.
Yes, you've got, at one stage, don't you have her saying, don't you have her performing in the nude?
Oh, no, she was at a party in the nude.
Oh, she was at a party in the nude. Excuse me.
Yes, she had a bath in the middle of the lounge room and just walked around nude. Yes, and they often seem to walk around nude. I mean, there's stories about Dulcidema and people like that up in the Blue Mountains on some picnic, and they're all just walking around in the nude with handbags. You know, that just sort of...
Do you think there was a lot of alcohol and a lot of drugs involved? And I'm wondering whether that would have tipped B over in terms of the pre-existing condition that she had might have been triggered or exacerbated by substances.
So she didn't drink, and yet she was surrounded by a lot of heavy drinking. They all, you know, bohemians drank a lot. And, you know, that was the great thing about the rise of the house or flat parties, because people could consume alcohol where in other places it was restricted. You know, there were pubs closed at a certain hour and only some places sold alcohol after hours. And, you know, there was all this, you know, the Lindsay brothers write about, you know, most of their time was consumed by finding alcohol. You know, everything was sort of was around. I mean, Packy's was a dry establishment, but everyone, all the patrons hid their bottles in pot plants up on the roof. So it was absolutely, alcohol was key, but she did not drink. And that was a difference with her. In fact, she used to say, I can't stand going to parties where people are drunk because it ruins the conversation. So she didn't drink, and she never, to our knowledge, took any drugs. She said, people assume that I take dope, she used to say, but I, you know, I'm not interested in that.
It probably would have had a terrible effect on her neurologically, given the existing condition that she had. She does have this irreverent sense of fun, a cheeky nature, an appetite for, well, a kind of a desire to shock, an appetite for being naughty. And she does use the word fun to describe some of her outrageous behaviour. What would you characterise was her idea of fun?
Her idea of fun was upsetting the establishment. That was her idea of fun. Her idea of fun was disrupting everyday life, you know, in a way that amused her. That was her idea of fun.
So she was obviously very successful at doing that, and the trademark thing became, as you said before, this business of hopping into and out of cars, whether they belong to private drivers or taxis, and then hopping on and off trains, which sounds quite dangerous to me, and trams. And in all of this, I mean, now we understand this desire for motion was induced by her illness. But the thing was that she never wanted to pay for rides, and she got into terrible fights and arguments because of her unwillingness to pay for rides. What was that unwillingness to pay about?
So there's a couple of things. One is that, yes, I think she just didn't want to pay. I think she wanted to save money. She was always on a limited income. We must remember that her father had given her an income out of when she finally escaped from the asylums of £3 roughly a week. And that didn't really increase with inflation over the years. So her income and her way of living was reduced substantially over time. I think she did think of it as a way of saving money if she could get out of it. But reality was it cost her more money because she was constantly paying fines.
Quite.
You know, so to avoid it, you know, for a rational person, there's a whole lack of logic in this. You know, she, you know, to avoid paying tuppence on a tram, you know, she'd end up with a £2 fine. She developed this very strange idea that, and she was convinced by it. It was some kind of revelation that came to her in 1939, she said, that if she got into a cab and she didn't tell the driver where she was going, she didn't have to pay for the ride. So in other words, if the cab already had a passenger in there and they were going somewhere, she could just get in and she didn't have to pay for it. So this was her thing. However, most of her clashes with taxi drivers happened when she was a paying customer and they didn't want to take her, because then she would insist on it was her right to be in the cab. And that's when things got very violent.
I mean, sometimes violent, sometimes it has to be said also some of these episodes are farcical or near farcical. I think of all the episodes, the most disruptive episode actually that I like the most in the book doesn't happen in a taxi. It happens in the water at Manly Beach.
Ah, yes.
Could you tell us what happened at Manly?
Sure. So it's 1938. There's an inter-Dominion and interstate surf carnival happening. So life-saving teams are competing from New Zealand and all across Australia. There's a crowd there of 10,000. And the beach is cordoned off, and the beach is full of lifesavers and beach inspectors. And B had already been banished from Manly Beach a decade before for swimming with a knife. But anyway, she decided to return this day. And so the heat's going on, the crowd's there, everything's happening. And all of a sudden, they noticed this one lone swimmer swimming out beyond the flags, beyond the buoys, and into the area of the competition. So the beach inspector sends out a boat of lifesavers to bring this swimmer in. And every time they get her in the boat, she jumps back out again. And so then they send a second boat out to assist the first boat. Those two boats collide. One of the lifesavers falls out of the boat and gets hit by an oar and has to be taken to hospital to get his forehead stitched. And in the meantime, they still can't get this swimmer in. Finally, the inspector, who is beach inspector, who's furious by this stage, goes out himself with another boat of lifesavers. I don't know who's competing at this stage because they're all out trying to rescue this woman, and brings her into shore. And by this time, there's a policeman on the shore and he starts to get her details, and she doesn't want to give her name. And in the end, she says it's B Miles of Bourke Street, Darlinghurst. And he starts to write it down, and then she turns around and promptly goes back into the surf again. And by this time, the beach inspector is absolutely frothing at the mouth, and he decides to go out and bring her in himself. But also by this stage, the crowd has started to notice what's happening and turn their attention from the competition to these now two figures facing off waist deep in the surf against each other. And he goes to put his hand on her, and she says, "Do not put your hand on me." And he unwisely ignores her. And so she slapped him across the face and pulled his hair and said, "Do not touch me." And afterwards in court, he said, "You know, all of this happened in front of 10,000 people. I felt incredibly humiliated." But I like the argument from her lawyer, who was also a fellow Bohemian, Mr. Meager, who argued that because it had happened in the water, the court did not have any jurisdiction. But the judge wasn't having it and fined her £2.
Oh,
it was all over the papers. Even it went as far as New Zealand, that story.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. It's a fantastic, fantastic episode in a very flamboyant catalogue of episodes. Now, on a more serious note, what made her homeless?
What made her homeless was, so in the sort of towards the end of the war, so 43, 44, where there is an acute shortage of housing in Sydney, similar to what we're experiencing now, and rents were incredibly high. Landlords were demanding key money, which is a kind of bond, which was, you know, beyond the means of most people. She was rented a room somewhere in Darlinghurst. She went away for a few days, and when she came back, he had rented her room to someone else. So, and she could not get a room anywhere. And, you know, there was a banquet of choice for landlords about tenants, and she would have been right down the bottom of the list because by this time she was so notorious. I mean, she was in the papers every week, and her arrests were becoming more violent and her behaviour more outrageous, and her whole physical appearance had changed by this stage. So she was homeless. She had nowhere to go. So she went to Sydney Hospital. She had a particular fascination, you know, for someone who didn't like doctors, she had a real fascination with hospitals. She loved anaesthetics. So she...
What do you mean she loved anaesthetics?
She was obsessed with anaesthetics. She claimed that she had faked 15 illnesses to obtain anaesthetics. She went through operations to obtain anaesthetics. She loved.
What
the
you
feeling
mean? She just liked going under. She liked that feeling.
She liked that feeling.
Wow.
She liked that feeling. And you know, anaesthetics do produce this sense of euphoria when you wake up. Maybe it was that. But yeah, she liked it. So anyway, she went to Sydney Hospital, where she had some very difficult encounters with the staff there in the past.
Mm.
And she set herself up in one of the casualty wards in one of the cubicles. And she was there for about 3 weeks. and they couldn't get rid of her. They had to take her to court to evict her. And she said to the magistrate, look, if I had anywhere else to go, I'd go like a shot, but there was nowhere. So she then went to the steps of St. James Church opposite Hyde Park, and she was there, and Reverend Davidson said that she was allowed to stay there, but the parishioners complained. He went away, and whilst he was away, they called the police. The police came and evicted her again. And then it just progressed to a series of different sites. Famously, she was in the near the stormwater tunnel at Rushcutters Bay for quite a while.
Was she in any danger when she slept rough, when she was out in the open? I know she did have a knife, not just in the water at Manly, but she did have a knife. But was she ever assaulted when she was sleeping out in the open?
She claimed not to. She said she was very careful. She didn't sleep in empty buildings or anything like that. She said that was far too dangerous. She preferred to sleep out in the open. She said no. She was only once someone tried to molest her, she said. And then she said to them, you're not going to try and molest B. Miles, are you? And he said, oh, are you B. Miles? And got up and shook her hand. So she claimed not. Her main harassment came from the police.
Yes.
Who continually harassed her, used to come and, if she was sleeping on a bench, tip her over onto the ground or throw her shoes away.
Or in one case, you describe one officer urinating on her.
Urinating on her, which is just awful, horrible. Yeah,
was there anyone in the police force who was remotely kind and sympathetic towards her?
Yeah, I met a wonderful retired policeman who's now in his 90s, who was a probationary constable when he met B, and wrote this marvellous 5-page really detailed description of his encounter with her on a bus. And he was lovely. And I had some letters from retired policemen, particularly the mounted police, because she loved animals. So she was very friendly with them. So there was two or three that stood out who contacted me, who said they'd had good relationships with her. But the majority, no. Majority harassed her. It was harassment. And she and her relationships with them became more and more antagonistic. And, you know, and she would sort of say things very loudly in front of crowds of people, like, you know, unhand me, you fool, you know, that sort of thing. Or, you know, only a woman with low morals would marry a policeman, you know, those sort of statements.
Yes, I mean, there was a fair amount of goading that went on there. She did provoke. She provoked.
She absolutely provoked, and they responded in kind. Yeah.
Now, Rose, jumping forward to the end of her life, rather astonishingly, as you tell us, given her feelings about religion, she entered by choice a Catholic home for the poor. She quite liked the nuns, and she seems to have made a choice that was quite sensible in a way about the fact that she was getting on and maybe she needed a little degree of comfort. So what do you think about that period of her life?
Well, I think, see, by this stage she'd been in Belmore Park sleeping in the bandstand, and that was a time when she was getting particular harassment from the police, and she had gone down and sought sanctuary with Father John Hope at Christ Church St. Lawrence, and she had enjoyed his protection for, you know, about 7 years. And then he retired and a new regime came in and there was suddenly no space for her. She'd been sleeping on the laundry floor. And she was in a series of rooms afterwards, and she was getting, you know, more and more, you know, she was still strong, I think, but she had arthritis, she had diabetes, you know, she'd been living rough for a long time and it was impacting her health. And I don't know whether Father John arranged it or it's not clear how it happened, but she entered the Little Sisters of the Poor. And I think it was a very wise decision because she wasn't voluntarily homeless. It was a difficult period for her. And in the Little Sisters of the Poor, she was treated with absolute kindness. She had a bed. She had three meals a day. They lavished attention on her, and she loved attention. And she was able
to wash. I mean, there would have been laundry, there would have been showers, there would have been soap, all the things that she had had to go and seek out in order to maintain some kind of personal hygiene. Because one of the things she was quite particular about, even when she was homeless, was she did make efforts, didn't she, to go to baths, public baths, at least once a week.
Every day.
Every day.
She went to Dobson's every day. She had an arrangement with Dobson's in Reservoir Street that she would go there at 7 o'clock in the morning and wash her underwear and dry it on the heater. And then, and when Dobson's was closed on Sunday, she would go to Sydney Hospital and use their facilities. So yes, no, she was very particular about that. And Caroline, that was one of the things that I found incredibly moving and sad, was when she was hauled into court for an interaction with a taxi driver, and he had said that she was offensive and dirty, and that she couldn't be in his cab, and that a fight ensued, and she was in court, and she came to court to prove that she was not, that she was clean. And she produced a statement from Dobson's that said that she went there every day for a bath. And I thought, how brave and how humiliating to have to stand there in a courtroom and say, I'm not a dirty woman.
Absolutely.
And she said, the constable mistakes shabbiness for dirtiness. I'm a shabby woman, but I'm not dirty.
That's right. Yes, I found that very moving too.
Yeah.
Now, she had actually planned her funeral, and it was, of course, as unconventional as every other part of her life. I love the detail that she had arranged a jazz band to play Timey Kangaroo Down.
Calypso style.
And, of course, the irony was that her funeral cortege was lined with taxis that went out to Rookwood Cemetery, which is pretty funny given how the taxi industry felt about her generally. The way Bee summed up her own life in one of her writings was, she said it was a hard, cruel, good, full life. Is that how you see it?
Yes, but I would have said brave as well. I thought she was incredibly brave. I thought she was... It took a lot of courage to live the kind of life she lived, to really live by your convictions. And to be able to manage an illness that really decimated people's lives, mostly, and they ended up in these catatonic states, locked away, out of sight. But she was the opposite. She kept, no matter how much they pushed her to the edges, she kept bringing herself back into the centre all the time. And the other thing that drove her was, I think, she had this desire that never went away to be a critic, to be a social critic, and to tell people the way she felt that they should be living. And I think in order to do that, she had to have a public presence, and she maintained that public presence. You know, even at the end, you know, where she had this very flamboyant funeral. I mean, that was a performance, you know. And that's the other thing that I think that drove her. She was a performer. It was in her blood. You know, her grandmother had been a performer. Her father was a performer, a public performer. They were driven by this urge to both perform and, I think, to educate, you know, and she inherited that from her father.
And here is a small grab of an interview that Bee did in the 1970s, so that you can hear her characteristic way of speaking, which is a little indistinct and slurring at times, as if she were drunk, which she wasn't.
I'm for mateship. People being mates with each other. I have no friends for three reasons. One, I'm a truth thinker and a truth speaker, and I prefer and have to fly alone. Then because I cannot stand the priggery, cantery, snobbery, smuggery, hypocrisy, lies, flattery, conventional speech and behaviour upon which society is based. Then because I've been in jail so many times I can't count.
B. Miles has finally got the biography she deserves and the diagnosis, which puts a lot of her behaviour in a different light. I'd like to see a statue of her somewhere, maybe where she slept rough in Rushcutters Bay Park, or a park bench in her name. Something. There is, fittingly, a B. Miles Women's Housing Foundation in Sydney, which offers temporary housing to women with mental health problems. After our interview, Rose Ellis asked me to acknowledge Graham Edwards and Robert Kaplan for their published work on B suffering from encephalitis lethargica. And while we're on the subject of seeing things in a different light, if you listen to my conversation with Anna Funder about her interpretation of the marriage of Eileen O'Shaughnessy and George Orwell, you may be interested to know there's now been considerable pushback from various descendants of some of the key players and experts on Orwell. Funder has admitted to a couple of errors while standing by her central thesis. It just goes to show how active, sensitive, and ongoing the discussion is about public figures who are dead but who live on in contested scholarship and in the public imagination. Thank you for listening to Life Sentences. The podcast is produced on Dharawal Country by David Roach for Two Heads Media and edited by Kira Jordan for Pipewolf Media. Music is composed and performed by Amanda Brown. If you like what you've heard, please leave us a review on the Apple podcast platform, as it really helps us to find more ears.